That's B.B. King and Luciano Pavarotti singing for the benefit of children of war back in 1999. You're listening to Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Wednesday. Could you believe it? The 13th of February already. And a couple of updates. The Senate panel that was considering the nomination of Chuck Hagel, in fact, gave him the green light, but it's not yet over. He still has to come before the full Senate, and some of the members of the original committee, the Senate Armed Services Committee, are vowing to do whatever they can still to block him, but it seems as if the Democrats have enough votes to pull him through. Meanwhile, Jack Lew, the president's nominee to head up the Treasury Department, faces a grilling about huge bonuses he received from Citigroup and his plans for the government's finances when he testifies before the Senate panel today. Lew apparently received a $940,000 bonus in January 2009 after a brief stint at Citigroup. Aren't we supposed to be all that lucky? And just before that, the bank got a taxpayer-funded bailout. He also had a $56,000 investment with Citigroup, and the investment was placed and registered in the Cayman Islands. So there's going to be a little trouble there, but we'll see how smooth that sailing is. And even as we speak, Mayor Dave Bing, my eyes are playing tricks on me today, gives his State of the City address tonight, Mayor Dave Bing of Detroit, that is, the focus of which more than likely will be Governor Rick Snyder's plan to have the state take over the city's financial affairs. The city has been saddled with ballooning debt, and it cannot make its expenses anymore. It's gone way into debt. It used to be the fifth largest city in the United States and the largest city with the largest black population in the United States. But now that population is now just down to 700,000, and the tax revenues cannot meet the city's expenses. So when the financial administrator is assigned to Detroit, the thinking is that his chief task would be to place the city in bankruptcy. And if he does that, Detroit becomes the largest city going bankrupt. Well, lots and lots and lots of noise about what was going on in our fair capital yesterday. And a great many, preparations. You know how this is done, Hollywood style, lots and lots of panel discussions, what will happen, who knows what, who's going to say what. But it didn't take long for me to get mad. Very early on, the president said something that got my goat. Here is exactly what he said that made me mad. You know it's coming. Here's what he said.
It is our generation's task, then, to reignite the true engine of America's economic growth, a rising, thriving middle class. It is our unfinished task to restore the basic bargain that built this country. The idea that if you work hard and meet your responsibilities, you can get ahead. No matter where you come from, no matter what you look like or who you love, it is our unfinished task to make sure that this government works on behalf of the many and not just the few. That it encourages free enterprise, rewards individual initiative, and opens the doors of opportunity to every child across this great nation. The American people don't expect government to solve every problem. They don't expect those of us in this chamber to agree on every issue. But they do expect us to put the nation's interests before party. They do expect us to forge reasonable compromise where we can. For they know that America moves forward only when we do so together, and that the responsibility of improving this union remains the task of us all.
Okay, so you spotted why I got mad really early. That phrase that just grinds my gears, the middle class. This president doesn't seem to understand that he's actually engaging in the wrong kind of class warfare. When you already know that the wealthy are doing fine, you don't have to worry about them, they have more than enough money to hire their lawyers to protect their assets and so forth, great. And then the only other group that you're telling America that they need to be worried about, and certainly that the government is worrying about, is the so-called middle class. And nobody knows what it is, because it's many things to many people. And I think we need to ask him just exactly who he's talking about, because I know he's not talking about. All right, so let me not get back into that mode. I'm going to maintain my blood pressure. That's right, calm down. Calm down. Okay. So having said that, he also goes on to say all these little silly cliches about, you know, hearkening back to good old Republican values of rugged individualism. You know, if you work hard, you could progress in life. First of all, that's not true, because a lot of people who are wealthy don't work hard at all and did not work hard to become wealthy. And secondly, there is no class of folk more familiar with working hard than the poor and the working poor. They know the benefits of working hard because that's what they do every single day. So, you know, get off of this kick of, you know, if you work hard, you know, next thing you would tell us, you could do anything, you could be anything you want to be. It's like somebody sprinkled fairy dust. Oh, come on here. All right. So I'm getting over that. Here's the next little thing that offended me.
I realize that tax reform and entitlement reform will not be easy. The politics will be hard for both sides. None of us will get 100% of what we want. But the alternative will cost us jobs, hurt our economy, visit hardship on millions of hard-working Americans. So let's set party interests aside and work to pass a budget that replaces reckless cuts with smart savings and wise investments in our future. And let's do it without the brinksmanship that stresses consumers and scares off investors. The greatest nation on earth cannot keep conducting its business by drifting from one manufactured crisis to the next. We can't do it. Let's agree right here, right now, to keep the people's government open and pay our bills on time and always uphold the full faith and credit of the United States of America. The American people have worked too hard for too long, rebuilding from one crisis to see their elected officials cause another.
Okay. Let me get really serious about this. It looked like a State of the Union address. It had all the bells and whistles. But that's not what was going on there. This president, when you tear away all of the production value that accrued to this one event, it was like, you know, I expected, you know, trumpets blaring as he entered, you know, like the thrill in Manila or something, you know, a big event. It's a media event. No, this is supposed to be a talk with the nation. And when you tear all of the things away from, you take the veneer off, you find that essentially we were called to the table, but were served warmed over food. Nothing really was new. There are no new ideas out there. There's no new approach really. It was astonishing that people found so much to discuss in great detail and to analyze. I analyzed it. And just about everything the president touched on has in one way or the other been touched before. Now, what does that mean? It means everybody's acting. But the president was actually, despite all of his confidence and, you know, he was relaxed and, you know, all of that. But in fact, the president was making a public concession. This is my theory. He was admitting that as smart as he thought he was, as smart as all the whippersnappers around him think that they are, as smart as this administration thinks it is, a bunch of wily old Republicans beat them to at their own game. They didn't get a thing done in 4 years, and it is quite possible they're not going to get a thing done in the next 4 years. And there's a reason. That very attitude of smugness, we are smart, we are young, we got it. We don't even have to talk to you. I encourage you to take a hint from Hillary Clinton's attitude before Congress when she is called before, at her great inconvenience, to actually fulfill part of the task associated with her job. That attitude. There is clearly animus between the Obama administration and Congress. And within Obama's own cabinet, you can see the reason for the exodus of so many people who probably came in with the idea that they were joining a team that would work like a well-oiled machine together to accomplish all these high-minded goals and objectives, only to find that it really is a secret club of snotty people who decided that their credentials entitle them to privacy. They don't want governance. They want privacy in governance. And although it is not publicly discussed, you can see what is happening here. The president has turned people off. His administration is turning people off. And that is why they can't get anything done. The old buzzards down there, they know how to put stumble blocks in your way. And let's be real. I mean, this is the world of hypocrites. And some of them are the hippoest crits you will ever meet. it's in their blood. They smell a victim. And the more you maintain yourself as being entitled to conduct the affairs of state as if it were a private enterprise, they will teach you a lesson. They will teach you a lesson. What he was saying, all these words, it sounded, you know, let's get together. It was saying indirectly, I am ready now. I got it. I got your point. You made your point, and I got it. And I'm ready now to see if we can sit down and work. It is not about me being the president and you doing my bidding, and I'm so smart I could do end runs around you and govern by executive order. No, there's a process. there's a process. Now, I'm the last person to go championing the cause of the Republicans, but there's a process, and I can see what is going on there. But the president also is insulting the nation, and he has to understand that. All of that pomp and circumstance, and you have nothing new to say. And you have props. You know, poor 102-year-old woman, we dragged from Little Haiti. She should be in bed resting up, but she's a prop. And Gabrielle Gibbons is another prop. And look at that one is a prop. And it's show and tell. It was very upsetting to me that this is the level of discourse that we're getting from the highest levels of government. We're supposed to be taking care of business. The State of the Union message sounded like a campaign speech. It doesn't sound like a president who has a plan of action. It sounds like, okay, I'll throw this against the wall, I throw that against the wall, and see what sticks. And I know I have the undivided attention of the nation, a whole bunch of people are looking at me right now, and it's about saying all the right things and getting all the right emotional charges out of the words so people can identify with the president. It's none of those things, my friends. It is about the nation being in really serious trouble. And the president by now should have learned that governing is a two-way street. It was impressive that he actually articulated that last night, and he did so to signal to the Republicans that he has learned the lesson. He got it now. And maybe his public act of contrition, however indirectly he expressed it, is a signal that they would interpret as being willing to sit down and talk. Because hanging in the balance is a nation full of people who don't know what's next. You have to listen to language and how he uses language. Remember I said the State of the Union is strong. Well, he said it, except he said it this way. He said the State of the Union is stronger, the comparative form of the word, which could only mean either the previous president didn't do his job or it was stronger than it used to be. He did something to make it stronger. Either way, you know, all these crafty little ways of saying things so they could either mean this or they could mean that. No. Our president has been given permission to lead. And leadership is not dictatorship. Leadership is a process. And you have to observe the process. As, quote, liberal as he would want people to think that he is, I've already discussed here. He's a DLC man. He's a Democratic Leadership Council man. And that means that he's going to do exactly what Clinton did, bring the Democratic Party, the whole Democratic Party, to a conservative or, at the very least, a centrist position. There will be no major overhauls. None of the things that are discussed here as reforms are actual reforms. I've said it 500 times. They are tweaks to, you know, a little tweak here and a little tweak there. This is not, a reformation occurring. And getting people all excited because, well, you know, you put out an executive order and you say that you order the Centers for Disease Control to study gun violence a little deeper, and people are going crazy over that. The situation is jobs. And stop talking this middle-class nonsense because you're offending a whole bunch of folk. You're literally telling people, anybody else under that, well, you don't matter because middle-class people work hard. You don't work. You're one of the takers. I'm relating to the people who pay the taxes. You're not one of them. He's actually saying that to a huge chunk of the American population. All right. But you would think that in this Madeira that, you know, there was nothing good that happened, but you'd be wrong. And it came from a really unexpected place. You wouldn't believe it. I had a chuckle when I listened to Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. And here he is, a Tea Party man, trying his best to sound refreshingly original.
Good evening. I speak to you tonight from Washington, D.C. The state of our economy is tenuous, but our people remain the greatest example of freedom and prosperity the world has ever known. People say America is exceptional. I agree. But it's not the complexion of our skin or the twists in our DNA that make us unique. America is exceptional because we're founded upon the notion that anyone, in fact everyone, should be free to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. You know, for the first time in history, men and women were guaranteed in America a chance to succeed based not on who your parents were, but on your own initiative and your desire to work. We're in danger, though, of forgetting what made us great. The president seems to think the country can continue to borrow $50,000 every second. The president believes that if we can just squeeze more money out of those who are working, I don't think it'll work. The path we are on is not sustainable, but few in Congress or in this administration seem to recognize that their actions are endangering the prosperity of this great nation. Ronald Reagan said, "Government is not the answer to the problem. Government is the problem." Tonight, the president told the nation he disagrees. President Obama believes that government is the solution. More government, more taxes, more debt. What the president fails to grasp is that the American system that rewards hard work is what made America so prosperous. What America needs is not Robin Hood, but Adam Smith. In the year we won our independence, Adam Smith described what creates the wealth of nations. He described a limited government that largely did not interfere with individuals and their pursuit of happiness. All that we are, all that we wish to be is now threatened by the notion that you can have something for nothing, that you can have your cake and eat it too, that you can spend $1 trillion every year that you don't have. I was elected to the Senate in 2010 by people who were worried about their country, worried about their kids, and worried about their future. I thought I knew how bad it was until I got here. It's worse than I could have ever imagined. Congress is debating the wrong things. Every debate in Washington is about how much to increase spending, a little or a lot. How much to increase taxes, a little or a lot. The president does this big, oh, woe is me, over the $1.2 trillion sequester cuts in spending that he endorsed and he signed into law. Some Republicans are now joining him. Few people understand that the sequester doesn't even cut any spending. It just slows the rate of growth. Even with the sequester, if it goes through, government will grow over $7 trillion over the next decade. Only in Washington could an increase in $7 trillion in spending over a decade be called a cut. So what is the president's answer? Over the past 4 years, he has added over $6 trillion in new debt and may well do the same in a second term. What solutions does he offer? He takes entitlement reform off the table and seeks to squeeze more money out of the private sector. He says he wants a balanced approach. What the country really needs is a balanced budget. Washington acts in a way that your family never could. They spend money they don't have. They borrow from future generations. And then they blame each other for never fixing the problem. Tonight, I urge you to demand a new course. Demand Washington change their ways or be sent home. To begin with, we absolutely must pass a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. The amendment must include strict tax and spending limitations. Liberals complain that the budget can't be balanced, but if you cut just one penny from each dollar we currently spend, the budget would balance within 6 or 7 years. The penny plan has been crafted into a bill that millions of conservatives across the country support. It is often said there's not enough bipartisanship up here. That's not true. In fact, there's plenty of bipartisanship. Both parties have been guilty of spending too much, of protecting their sacred cows, of backroom deals in which everyone up here wins, but every taxpayer loses. It's time for a new bipartisan consensus. It's time Democrats admit that not every dollar spent on domestic programs is sacred. And it's time Republicans, myself included, realize that military spending is not immune to waste and fraud. Where would we cut spending? Well, let's start with ending all foreign aid to countries that are burning our flag and chanting death to America. In addition, the president could begin by stopping selling or giving F-16s and Abrams tanks to Islamic radicals in Egypt. Not only should the sequester stand, many pundits say the sequester's far short, that we need $4 trillion in cuts. If you were to freeze spending, it would actually be called $9 trillion in Washington. If we don't, we're in danger of having our credit rating downgraded. Now, both parties will have to agree to cut. We have to work together, or we'll never fix our fiscal mess. Bipartisanship is not what is missing in Washington. Common sense is. Trillion-dollar deficits hurt us all. Printing more money just feeds the never-ending appetite for spending, and it hurts us all. We pay higher prices every time we go to the supermarket or the gas pump. The value of the dollar shrinks with each new day. Contrary to what the president claims, big government and debt are not a friend to the poor and the elderly. Big government debt keeps the poor poor and saps the savings of the elderly. This massive expansion of debt destroys savings and steals the value of your wages. Big government makes it more expensive to put food on the table. Big government's not your friend. The president offers you free stuff, but his policies keep you poor. Under President Obama, the ranks of America's poor have swelled to almost 1 in 6 people. We are now at an all-time high in long-term unemployment. Millions of Americans are struggling and out of work. The cycle must be broken. The willpower to do this will not come from Congress. I've seen how they act. It must come from the American people. Next month, I'll propose a 5-year balanced budget, a budget that last year was endorsed by taxpayer groups across the country for its boldness and for actually solving the problem. I will work with anyone on either side of the aisle who wants to cut spending. But in recent years, there's been nobody to work with. The president's passed massive tax hikes and spending increases. And you know how many people he gets to vote for his budget? Zero. Nobody voted for his budget. Not a single Democrat voted for the president's budget. How's that for leadership? But at least he tried. Senate Democrats have not even produced a budget in the entire time that I've been in office. This is shameful. It's a display of incompetence that illustrates their lack of seriousness. This year, they say they'll have a budget, but after just raising taxes by hundreds of billions of dollars, they now say that their budget's going to include more tax hikes. The president tonight said he wants to squeeze more money out of folks. We must stand firm. We must say no to any more tax hikes. Only through lower taxes, less regulation, and more freedom will the economy begin to grow again. Our party is the party of growth, jobs, and prosperity, and we will boldly lead on these issues. Under the Obama economy, 12 million people are out of work. During the president's first term, 800,000 construction workers lost their jobs, and another 800,000 simply gave up looking for work. With my 5-year budget, millions of jobs would be created by cutting the corporate tax, cutting the corporate income tax in half, by creating a flat personal income tax of 17%, and by cutting the regulations that are strangling American businesses. The only stimulus ever proven to work is leaving more money in the hands of those who earned it.
That was Senator Rand Paul. Now, I shared this with you not because I'm a Tea Party sympathizer, no. I shared it with you to give you a sense of what it sounds like when people are thinking. Now, make no mistake, this is a political appeal, And he is trying to build a party, and he may very well be a presidential candidate in 2016. However, I'm talking about the level of engagement in making an argument. Whether you want to support the Tea Party or not, you have to respect the fact that he's put forward a credible case. I mean, you could pick it apart. We could all pick it apart. I'm talking about the intent here, because it's the same intent. Any speech is an effort to persuade. So that is his vantage point. These are the things that concern him, and he has indicated that it is not just about the Democrats or the Republicans, it's both parties. So he's offering very early a sign that he is going to take the middle road. He's not pro this and anti that. He's for the people. Okay, we get that. But what we really appreciate here is the effort he makes to make a sensible and intelligent argument about the thing that he, or the things that he says are necessary to consider if the tide is going to be turned around. This is what I expect of a president. Explain to the people why it is in their interest to get A, B, C, and D done. Not that I have done so and so and so and so. You already won. You know, do we have to remind the president that he has already won the election? He doesn't have to campaign anymore. You got it. We put you there, okay? You in the White House. Explain to people, the listening audience, what is going to be the benefit of this program or the detriment of that approach? That's what we expect when I'm listening to hear the State of the Union. I want to know your rationale for what it is you say you want to do, your high priority items. So I don't want to hear about your economic theories about, you know, as long as we support the middle class, that this is a government that supports the middle class, it makes you sound, I hate to say the word, it makes him sound silly to keep saying this thing. Because we don't know what it is. And we know, insofar as people use the term, there are about 400 different definitions of what the middle class is. And from my perspective, I think I know only three black people who are in the middle class, the way most people define it. You know, we have middle class aspirations. As the president said, we should aspire to be middle class. It's that good. But if you are aspiring, you're not yet there, so he's not talking to you anyway. All right. Let's kind of take this all in. After all, it's a speech, because the bottom line is you look at the action and it's very disturbing, but you have to see how things fit. Our president is a guy who is chastened. He has been spanked, and he indicated last night, I got the message. I promise that I will be a bit more conciliatory and work together with you. And the signal that he's willing to work together is the last thing that he would even think of saying, is that one of the biggest cuts that they could make is to pork barrel projects in all of the bills that they have passed. See? He knows how to concede. I thank you very much for listening and tuning in. And thank you so much. I'm new to Facebook. I really am trying to figure out how it all works. So bear with me while I get the hang of that. But, I mean, I've been inundated with requests. And it's so wonderful. It's a good sense of growing a great family right here at PRN.FM. In the meantime, you can be an ambassador, as you should. I mean, that's your role too. You know, we're all in this thing together. Try and help us build the audience at PRN.FM. Talk to the folks in your circle and let them know this is where you tune in, not just to Lead Stories, but to any program on the station. Coming up next is Mike Fader. You want to stay tuned for that. And you can reach me, as always, at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. Oh, I gave you the wrong information. I said Mike Fader. Oh, it's Jack Rasmus. Is up next with Alternative Visions. Thank you. They need to update that on the page. I saw it on the page today. So thank you, and we'll meet you tomorrow.